Okay, well, as people are filtering in, I want to welcome everyone. I see Dale to our clubhouse today with Robert Trusinski. He's chosen a topical topic, capitalism and Christmas. I want to remind people that we are going to be recording so that we can put this up on our podcast platform. And we also just had our senior scholar, Professor Stephen Hicks, popping into the room. So we will would love to get your questions or comments, but I'm going to let Rob start us off by telling us a bit about the topic.
Yeah, all right. So, as you know, there's a sort of killjoy patrol out there that is always on the lookout for any sign that somebody's having fun and enjoying themselves and making the most out of life, and they've got to find a way to put a damper on that. And during this time of year, the usual way of doing that is to complain about Christmas, and Christmas is too commercial, and people are buying too many things, and they're spending too much, and they're missing the true spirit of the season. So the usual complaint about Christmas, if coming from both sides, from the religious people on the right and from the sort of anti-capitalist left, is that Christmas is too commercial. So what I wanted to share here is now, I don't know if Jen, if there's a way to put this out on a chat for Clubhouse, but I also just referred to it on Twitter in response to the announcement for this meeting. A great article that was published last year, about this time last year, in the Wall Street Journal by Jason Zweig called How Capitalism Saved Christmas. And it's a great overview, sort of putting giving the historical facts that refute some of these claims about Christmas being too commercial, and basically arguing that Christmas as we know and enjoy it today is very much a product of capitalism. It emerged from the Industrial Revolution, from the growth of commerce, from the development of the department store, right? Had that because you went and you go window shopping and you go shopping and you buy gifts. It was because of all the goods pouring out of the factories and into the department stores in urban centers, and that was really what fueled the growth of Christmas as we celebrate it in any recognizable form today. So there's some interesting little details from that history, some of which I'd known before and some of which was new to me. Some interesting details I wanted to pull out. One of the points that he makes is that before really the 19th century, Christmas was a period of revels and disorder and mobs going around carousing in the streets in a very disorderly and unrespectable way. And actually, because of this, for a while under the Puritans, now this goes against the sort of the religious claim that Jesus is the reason for the season. Under the Puritans in Massachusetts, for a while, celebrating Christmas, even taking the day off, was banned, and you could be fined for it. So that gives sort of puts to rest the idea of this of a uniquely Christian origin for Christmas as we celebrate it today. And you can see sort of leftovers of this if you've seen songs like there's one, Here We Come a Wassailing, right? The wassailing was basically a roving band would come around. This is the primitive origin of caroling, and the less pleasant origin of caroling is a roving band would come around and they would stand outside of your house and basically demand alcohol. They demand beer. And that was, wassailing. As here we come a wassailing, and where we're coming to your door to sing at you and shout at you and make noise and demand to be given strong drink so we could basically get drunk on Christmas. You can also see it in the song "We Wish You a Merry Christmas." There's that line about how now bring out some figgy pudding. And you'll notice that in the lyrics, the singers get increasingly insistent. They say, "We won't go until we've got some." And it gets a little ominous there. And that also dates back to these early revels where, they came door to door singing, and you better bring out something for them to drink and something for them to eat, or you might be in trouble. All right, so this is the rowdier origin of Christmas. And really, that starts to just, it's only in the 19th century after the Industrial Revolution as the country becomes more commercial, as the growth of commerce and retail and department stores, that Christmas begins to take on its more respectable sort of middle class, orderly,
version, and also a version that is centered around the family and around giving gifts to friends and family. One of the key turning points is Clement Seymour writing, I think it's called A Visit from St. Nicholas is the title, is the official title. Of course, we all know it as, you know, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. He writes that poem, and that sort of supercharges this idea of, you know, Santa Claus coming down the chimney and bringing gifts to the family, and that it becoming much more of a middle-class, family-oriented holiday that's about giving gifts to the people you love. Now, the hit part of history here that is not covered in this Wall Street Journal article that I'm recommending, again, it's called How Capitalism Saved Christmas. The part that isn't covered there is really the later history of how we got to the anti-commercialism of that comes in the Christmas season. And I think the pattern here is that, as usual, capitalism achieves something amazing, and then the intellectuals come along to explain, quote-unquote explain, what capitalism did, which ends up meaning they badmouth capitalism and blame capitalism for everything that's bad, while taking for granted all the good things it accomplished. And I think that's sort of my explanation, deeper explanation behind Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol. So this is about 20, 25 years after Clement Seymour, The Night Before Christmas. In the 1840s, Dickens comes along and writes A Christmas Carol. And in line with his sort of generally anti-capitalist outlook, he creates this character of Scrooge, who's this caricature of everything that's bad about capitalism and commerce. And it shows commerce. He really sets up this idea of the man of commerce, the man of business, being grumpy and misanthropic and opposed to the celebration of Christmas and opposed to the spirit of the holiday. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, this is sort of like around the same time as Dickens, you know, Karl Marx is coming along. And capitalism is producing all these amazing things, this amazing growth in wealth and the standard of living, building bridges and railroads and all these amazing things. And he comes around and says, oh, this is all terrible. We have to get rid of it. And so Dickens is basically, you know, in the middle of Christmas as this rising holiday fueled by the Industrial Revolution, fueled by commerce, fueled by the opening of the first department stores. And again says, oh, this is all terrible. It's all over commercialized, and we need to turn against the man of business and portray them as the villains. And that's a theme that starts with him and sort of continues. My other sort of thing I love to hate is the movie It's a Wonderful Life, the old Jimmy Stewart movie. Because you remember that one, it's another Christmas classic that's actually really quite horrible when you think about it. Because the essence of it is you get this character, George Bailey. You got this character, George Bailey, who, the basic setup is at every point throughout the story, he has to sacrifice himself for the good of somebody else. And basically, it's a story about how it's okay for the small town you live in to crush your dreams for your entire life. And then at the end, you should accept that and be grateful for it. So it's this real downer of a message as a real sort of hardcore altruist message. As a Christmas classic, and that's from the 40s. And then even when I was a kid, the big classic that came along was the Charlie Brown Christmas. And I've watched that recently and saw that parts of it recently and really didn't like it because it's a lot of lecturing and hectoring. Linus spends the whole thing complaining about how commercialized Christmas is. So you see how this drumbeat of Christmas is too commercial keeps getting pounded into us. Now, an interesting detail from that Wall Street Journal article is that some of this came from a society started in the early 20th century, I think, or late 19th or early 20th century. I can't remember the exact date, but it was started by J.P. Morgan's daughter talking about how Christmas had become too commercial. People were spending money unnecessarily on all these gifts, and they should devote themselves to the service of others. And it just struck me as something out of Atlas Shrugged, where you have, I mean, this is J.P. Morgan's daughter. You go get wealthier, you know, a greater wealth and privilege than that. So it's very much out of Atlas Shrugged, the sort of super wealthy person who claim they don't care about money or material things because they've always had plenty of it. And the sort of condescension of J.P. Morgan's daughter telling us we're too commercial and are spending too much money. And but now in the modern version, though, you get, of course, that that sort of comes from the left, the anti-commercialism of the left, the anti-capitalism of the left. And the more recent version you're going to get is you're going to get the Christians saying, oh, well, this is right. It's a Christian holiday. And they'll complain about the war on Christmas. And they say we should be focused on the religious meaning of it. So when it comes to that, I want to also point out that Christianity did kind of steal Christmas. Now, obviously, the name Christ Mass, you know, is a Christian name. But what the why is it on December 25th? Why does it have the form, this holiday have the form it has? Well, it has that form from Christians coming along and basically stealing or borrowing existing pagan holidays and incorporating all those traditions and then trying to give them a Christian meaning. This is a process that's called syncretism, you know, the Greek or Latin root meaning trying to bring things together. And this is a pattern that Christianity used a lot in its early spread, is they would come along and say, well, look, you know, you've got some existing pagan tradition, existing pagan gods, existing pagan heroes. Rather than fight that, we're going to allow you to keep having those things. If we try to make you give up these festivals and these holidays, people are going to hate us. So rather than make them give up those things, we're going to take it over and give, we'll let you have that holiday, but we'll give it a Christian meaning. So for example, Easter, even the name Easter comes from Istra, I think if it's pronounced correctly, which is a Germanic goddess of spring. It was a spring festival, a pagan spring festival celebrated by the Germans. And the Christians came along, they kept the name, they kept the celebration, they kept the holiday, and it's there to celebrate the return of spring. You know, and the snow's melting and the grass and the trees and everything's growing again. And you're celebrating that, but then they said, okay, we're going to attach it to a Christian meaning having to do with the story of Christ. And they did something similar with Christmas. Christmas is really the Saturnalia festival that happens around today. It happens around December 21st. It's celebrating the solstice, the fact that the days have been getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and now we're at the point where they're going to start getting longer again. That's something to celebrate. So there's always been solstice festivals. Historically, and you know, among all pagan groups, the Greeks and Romans celebrated their solstice festivals. The Roman one was called Saturnalia, and the Christians, you know, there's no reason to think Christ was born on December 21st, 25th. None of that. I think actually that may have even been taken from Mithraism, which was a previous pre-existing Roman religion. And so what they did is glommed on to that. So we don't know when Christ was born. We're going to say it was on the 25th. So that we can take this Saturnalia festival that everybody loves and we can give it a Christian meaning. So for the people who want to say Christmas is really about Christ and Christianity, yes, for the last several centuries, yes, but its original origins, you know, everybody's always had a solstice fest, a winter solstice festival, and its ultimate origins were pagan. And I particularly like the solstice because I think it's also a good scientific astronomical mile marker to be something to celebrate. So that's what I sort of wanted to set up as the context for the actual relationship between capitalism and Christmas and between commercialism and Christmas. And good opportunity to just throw a little shade at Frank Capra and Charles Dickens for their contributions on their Christmas stories.
Well, I don't know if I completely agree with you about It's a Wonderful Life. I think in some sense, it also is the story of the power of individualism and George Bailey finding out what would happen if he had never been there. Of course, he had a savings and loan, so, you know, he wasn't a social worker. And, you know, he also was able to make a choice, a rational choice between the short-term pleasure of going off on his honeymoon versus, you know, what he was going to come back to, which would have been a completely changed town. So I think there's a possibility of having a debate on some of these topics. I want to recognize a few people that are with us today. Professor Hicks, as I mentioned, Dale Bottoms, Nina, I see some other donors here. So please raise your hand if you have a question for Rob. And a question about Christmas, a question about objectivism, a question about capitalism. And we will get to them. So, Rob, maybe you could also talk a little bit about how Ayn Rand viewed Christmas.
Right. She actually wrote an article about celebrating Christmas as a capitalist and an atheist. And the big thing she said was that the big thing that stands out to me is as her basic message was, you know, she said, we say Merry Christmas, not weep and repent. So I think it's, you know, the idea is that the emphasis on Christmas is very much about the enjoyment of life. I mean, you think about it. I mean, this is the original sort of pagan origin of it is it's the winter. And among other things that happens in winter is, first of all, most people don't have a lot to do right about now because in an agrarian society, you know, the crops are all in. You can't plant any new crops yet for the spring. So this is sort of an idle downtime. But it's also a time, and it's also a time when it gets especially dark and cold and you need some sort of celebration or revelry to lift everyone's spirits and to sort of keep up your spirits over the coldest, darkest part of the winter. But you're also celebrating the fact that the coldest and darkest part, or at least the darkest part, is over because, you know, the days get longer every day after this. It really has, you know, in its earliest origins, it was basically a celebration of life. And in its 19th century incarnation, that sort of the way Christmas was formed into its modern form in the 19th century and early 20th century, it was very much about specifically about celebrating the home and the family, and seeing the enjoyment of your kids as they get this cornucopia of gifts underneath the tree. So it's very much about celebrating prosperity and celebrating love love for the people that are closest to you.
And benevolence. I mean, she talked about that this was, it was a benevolent, you were wishing the goodwill towards men was a sense of benevolence, of wanting other people's good fortune and seeing them, you know, as potential friends, partners. So I think that's a sense that.
Another little detail, by the way, from Jason Zweig's article is he says, and I don't know if this is true, but I hope it's true, which is he says that originally Merry Christmas, the word Merry meant drunk. And so he points out that it was actually in Clement Seymour's poem, Night Before Christmas, he says it is Happy Christmas. And that was like a change from merry to happy. Now, of course, that meaning has been lost and we've gone back to Merry Christmas. But another little, but it is definitely, you know, it's a holiday that's about happiness and about sharing happiness with other people.
Well, Merry Christmas, Roger. It's great to see you here.
Thanks. I was excited to get the ping in here. Interesting topic. The one area where that prevents me from diving headfirst into the objectivist pool is the philosophy around like a rejection of faith. I think that, you know, I don't need to get into a debate about the place that faith has in my life and so many others. But I was glad to hear you know, the recognition that there's a utility in having a holiday that spreads good cheer, and you don't need to be a Christian to participate. And in fact, the historical lessons that Christmas itself was borrowed from other traditions. And so we can take the best of everything. I try to take the best aspects of objectivism and put them into my life and apply them in a way that that makes my life more meaningful. And I think the most specific part of that is the idea that that pursuing happiness is virtuous, and the idea that that working against your own self-interest is both immoral and irrational. And I agree with that. But I was very interested in hearing the perspective that would be put forward on celebrating Christmas and embracing things like capitalism. And the last thing that I would just kind of finish with as a question is, when we look at this holiday and we see the gift giving component, some people would say that that giving gifts is this act of like selflessness. I actually think it's quite different. I don't know if Rob meant it this way, but when I heard him say, the joy of watching the open presents, there is a self-interest in that. It makes us feel good to give. And so I think gift giving, especially when it's not done with coercion, like on holidays such as like Valentine's Day, when there's a desire to want to give gifts, there is definitely a self-interest component to that that people play down. And I think we should own that more. And my question to Rob or to Stephen's on the stage too, is just to ask the question, should we promote the virtue of selfishness and how that applies to Christmas rather than making consumerism this bad thing, and promote how good it feels to be able to give and the feeling that it leaves with us?
Yeah, I would say more broadly that I put this on the perspective of talking about self-interest and love, that love is self-interested. In fact, it's a reflection of self-interest. This is something that even before Ayn Rand goes back to Aristotle, where in his Nicomachean Ethics, he has a whole section of where he addresses the question, should one love oneself or another most? And he makes the point that that your love for a friend, he talks about friendship mostly, your love for a friend is an extension of your love for yourself. And if you didn't love yourself, you wouldn't be able to love the values that you share with your friend. He said a friend is another self, so therefore you wouldn't be able to love your friend if you didn't first love yourself. So he's the first one to sort of come up with the idea behind Ayn Rand's phrase, in order to say I love you, one must learn first how to say the I. And the idea that there isn't a conflict between love and self-interest. And yes, the thing is that, human beings, everything proceeds from an understanding of human nature. Human beings are complex, immensely complex beings, and therefore psychologically complex beings. And we have this whole suite of psychological needs that flow from the complexity of our brains and the needs of our cognition. And one of those needs is the needs for companionship and for friendship. And that includes, of course, your the friends that you choose. It also includes your family. And especially the nuclear family, the wife and the kids and all of that. And so I really see Christmas especially as an extension of that idea of value and love for family. And one thing said, talking about selfish gift giving or self-interested gift giving, one sort of thing I try to do in giving gifts, and something I sort of teach my kids as a way of giving gifts, is that you search for the shared interest that you have with someone, that you try to find. If you're trying to pick a gift for someone, you pick something that you're interested in and they're also interested in, where you have this thing like, I found this really interesting and I think you would find it interesting too. And it sort of emphasizes this idea of the shared values and the Aristotelian point about the friend is another self, that you look for the values, that the things you enjoy in common, the values you share with someone else, and you sort of put your gift, organize your gift giving around that. And I like to use that as much as possible as a sort of criterion for the gifts I choose for people. And that and half the time when I give my kids books, I want to steal them and read them myself.
Stephen.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for that. Rob, I'm wondering if you've run across, if you have any thoughts on the Christians. It's a small movement who are also against Christmas, so to speak. So, the put Christ back in Christmas version of Christianity as opposed by these other Christians. And the kinds of arguments they make are that, well, December 25th wasn't really the date of Jesus' birthday, so they take seriously the historical argument. So in the interest of getting Christianity right, we shouldn't be celebrating on that day. Or they will point out that in the Bible, Jesus didn't celebrate his birthday, and it doesn't really seem like anybody celebrates their birthday. So celebrating one's birthday is a little bit egocentric and focused on the self. So we shouldn't be doing that even in the case of Jesus. So have you run across that sect?
I know there are more puritanical sects of Christians who are against celebrating Christmas. Like I said, even the original Puritans in New England apparently had a ban on celebrating Christmas for a while. And I think that that's not very common, though, today. And I think what's more common is the sort of modern religious conservative who wants to have it both ways. They want to have Christmas, and they want to have all the pleasant things about Christmas and all the celebration and all the secular parts of Christmas, including all the best Christmas songs, all the best Christmas songs which were written by Jews. It really is true. There's like probably a majority of the classic Christmas songs from like the 30s, 40s, 50s were written by Jewish songwriters, because of course, you know, it was a huge market. So, you know, you have these guys sitting around. There's a famous story about, you know, Mel Torme and some other guy sitting by a hotel pool in Miami in the middle of July writing the Christmas song, you know, the chestnuts roasting in an open fire thing. Because, you know, you want to have a big song for Christmas, you got to start writing it in July. You know, so they want to take all these sort of secular aspects of Christmas and all the things that people enjoy and love about Christmas. And then they want to try to have that but make sure that insist that it be connected to the Christian meaning. And I think it's similar to what the point Jennifer raised about It's a Wonderful Life, where It's a Wonderful Life is a very, the point she makes about how there's an aspect of individualism to it. And I think that's not accidental. That's sort of summarized. I mean, it's a Frank Capra movie. So he is the embodiment of sort of mid-20th century liberalism, old-fashioned 20th century liberalism, sort of FDR era liberalism. And it was very much this idea of this combination of an element of individualism and altruism, sort of trying to combine those two together. And so you get that on both sides, that they try to take the things people love about Christmas and then combine them with their own message of, you know, hardcore or whole message of altruism in the case of sort of secular altruism in the case of Frank Capra, or religious altruism in the case of today's Christians. And then, of course, you know, it all gets wrapped now these days, of course. It all gets wrapped into the culture war, and Fox News has to invent a war on Christmas every year, whether it's happening or not.
Yeah, if I can follow up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like your connection to the Puritans, and I think I joined in the conversation just at the tail end of when you were first mentioning the Puritans. So, but I wonder if you know, partly this is a kind of a psychological divide among Christians, or maybe it's a more sociological thing as well. But there is a streak of Christianity for whom all of this benevolence and goodwill among men is just not where they are religiously. For them, life really is a kind of grim, puritanical set of duties. So Christmas just strikes them as an alien holiday, and so they're resisting it, maybe on sense of life grounds, but conjoining that with the sense that, you know, we have to get the historical facts as well. But really, it's driven by just that's not what Christianity is. It's not about fun and celebration and so on. It's something darker and more duty oriented.
Yeah, I wrote a series of articles a while back. I'm still sort of working on them at a very slow pace, called An Atheist Reads the Bible. And it's looking through, you know, starting at the Old Testament and working through. And one of the things I wrote about there was the concept of a covenant. This is a sort of a dual aspect of the Christian religion, going all the way back to the Old Testament and to the various covenants made between God and the Israelites. And those covenants tend to, so the one I started with is the covenant is the story of Abraham and Isaac. This is where Abraham is told to bring his, you know, he's waited all this long time to have a son and heir, and he finally has a son and heir. and there's Isaac, and he's told, and then God says to him, come take Isaac to the mountaintop, to this altar, and he's supposed to sacrifice his son, humans engage in human sacrifice, kill his son as a sacrifice to God. And of course, when he gets to the top and he's just about to plunge the knife in, God stops him and says, no, you know, here's a lamb, sacrifice that instead. And there's all sorts of functions that serves in the narrative. But one of them is this idea that the double edge of the covenant, of the Judeo-Christian covenant, is on the one hand, you have to be willing to sacrifice everything, including the things that are most precious to you, to God. And then the other half of it is that if you are willing to sacrifice, God may not make you actually do it. And instead, what he does after after Abraham has proved his loyalty by being willing to sacrifice his son, God makes a promise to him, I will make you wealthy and prosperous, and your descendants will become a great people and a great nation on the earth. So it's this double edge of you have to be willing to sacrifice everything, but in return, he promises you prosperity and happiness and success. And that's been sort of the dual character of the Judeo-Christian tradition from the very, very beginning. Abraham is the beginning of that tradition. Later Christians come along and they get to sort of go on the spectrum of which half of the covenant do they like to emphasize. Do they like to emphasize the prosperity part? And so you get the natural religion ideas of the founding fathers, which is very much emphasizing the, if you follow the right moral rules, you will get prosperity. And our goal is to go forth and multiply and be fruitful and multiply and become prosperous. And the modern version of that would be sort of the Joel Osteen prosperity gospel types, who tell you how to live your best life now. And then there are the Christians who are very much on the opposite end. So a little anecdote from there is that there was an article recently, is in response to all the COVID stuff, an article in The Federalist, and I used to write for The Federalist, but an article by Joy Pullman, who's one of the people there, basically talking about how we shouldn't try to take precautions against COVID because death is good. And we should all want, as good Christians, we should all welcome death. And it's this horribly grim sort of death cult kind of thing. And I know Joy, so I know that that's sort of her, that's totally her interpretation of Christianity. And the funny thing is she once told me privately that she thought objectivism, the philosophy of objectivism and the objectivist morality was too harsh. And she has the harshest, bleakest version of Christianity you could possibly imagine is the thing she advocates. So like I said, there's that spectrum of you can emphasize the total sacrifice part of Christianity, of the Judeo-Christian tradition, or you can emphasize the be fruitful and multiply, I shall make you a great nation, the prosperity gospel sort of aspect of Christianity. And people get to decide where they go on that spectrum.
Rob, what would you say to people like Roger and to many others, we meet them at our conferences, mm-hmm. who are very attracted to, find a lot of utility in many aspects of objectivism, or just more specifically are really inspired by Rand's fictional literature, mm-hmm. but feel that they're not welcome, or maybe, Roger, I don't want to mischaracterize how you see it, or that it's a stumbling block for them. I wrote about this in my Wall Street Journal op-ed, Can You Love God and Ayn Rand? Mm-hmm. When I first came to the Atlas Society, I was amazed by how many, really devout Christians and Catholics, like Andy Puzder, who's this first speaker at our gala, had required each of his six children to read The Fountainhead before he allowed them to get their driver's permit. Or Randy Wallace, who wrote a magnificent screenplay of Atlas Shrugged, but who's a devout Baptist. And they just didn't see any contradiction between it, but, they weren't necessarily deep students of objectivism. So either, Stephen or...
Well, let me comment on that a couple times. It goes back to what I was saying is about the Abrahamic covenant, is that I think people who don't see any clash between religion and objectivism have to grapple with that Abrahamic covenant. and the fact that sacrifice is the idea of total sacrifice for your religion is a crucial central part of the Judeo-Christian tradition back to the beginning. So that's something that's not going to be consistent with objectivism, and you have to square those. On the other hand, the big thing I've sort of gotten into in the last 5 years or so, and I was turned onto this originally by a friend of mine named Pat Mullins, who's a professor of history, who he wrote a very good book about a guy named Jonathan Mayhew, who was he would have been one of the great founding fathers if he had lived. He died in, I think, 1765, so before at the very beginning of the conflicts between that led to the revolution. But he was hugely influential on a lot of the founding fathers. And from there, from reading about Jonathan Mayhew, I sort of explored a little bit the whole field of what's called natural religion. And because the thing about Jonathan Mayhew is you read a bunch of his sermons that he did. And he was a preacher. He's a Christian preacher. And he was teaching what he saw as the proper Christian morality. But it's this total enlightenment morality that is all based on the idea that God loves us and wants us to be happy, and so we should use our natural faculty of reason to exercise our independent private judgment and make the decisions that will lead to our greatest happiness. And you know, he actually talks about rational happiness being the goal of the Christian morality. So he sort of sounds like a proto-objectivist philosopher, and this was part of this whole school called natural religion, and it goes partly back to John Locke wrote an essay called On the Reasonableness of Christianity. And so it's this very enlightenment version of Christianity that's has a strong emphasis on reason and on following reason and on reason literally being the voice of God within us. You know, the idea is God gave us the faculty of reason, therefore he must have intended us to use it. And so therefore, if you follow reason, you are following the will of God. So it's heavy emphasis on reason, heavy emphasis on individual judgment because of that, an emphasis on the idea that, you know, that again, that other half of the Abrahamic covenant, which is that you're supposed to go out and be fruitful and multiply and to prosper and to enjoy your life. So there is that very strong tradition in Christianity that still survives. That is the other part of that, of the Abrahamic covenant, which is, the pro-life, pro-enjoyment part.
Stephen, did you have anything to add to that? Otherwise, I'm going to bring a couple people.
No, I don't want to go too much deep dive into history of Christianity and all the variations. So Rob's outline was nice.
Can I just say real quick, I'll be brief, is that a lot of people aren't necessarily deeply steeped or clinging to the entire origin story of where God came from. But a more deeply held belief is just that the universe was created, and therefore there's a belief in God. And where I find myself in problematic conversations is not when people arrive at a different conclusion that God doesn't exist, is that when people arrive at a conclusion that somebody else arriving at their own conclusion based on logic and reason and whatever other system that they might have for seeking truth is when it's rejected and when it's mocked. And I don't see that coming from your group. I really don't. I follow you guys on Facebook. I also follow the other Rand group. So it's not the leadership of these organizations, and it's not even necessarily in the philosophy. And I've read like Peacock books, and I don't see it coming from the leadership, but there's an ugliness of that seems to be present among the people that identify as objectivists, which makes it less welcoming for people that have a view that's just like one or two clicks away from what Rand would have approved of. And I think that's the idea that kind of keeps me away from like identifying as an objectivist, because there just seems to be this dogmatic approach to certain topics that I don't find helpful. And I almost feel that if you had the right people leading those discussions, they would maybe curate those conversations in a more healthy way. And I'm just curious, like, why that seems to be so prevalent in these spaces, especially in a space where logic and reason and, you know, and respect for individuality is supposed to be, you know, a prominent theme.
Yeah, well, there's always been a bit of a difference in this, and that, let's put it this way. I interviewed George Will a while back, and he describes himself as a low voltage atheist. And I sort of feel that same way too, I would describe myself as an atheist who doesn't have a chip on his shoulder. And that I've noticed that now I know I understand why this happens, because I noticed that in my general experience, the most fanatical and intolerant atheists are people who went to Catholic school when they were kids. So that's like, they're still trying to get back at the nuns. So they've got a chip on their shoulder because, and I think it's, if you had religion forced upon you in a dogmatic and intolerant way when you were young, that you sort of tend to rebel against that. I think I'm getting an echo here a little bit. I hope that somebody may need to mute.
Yeah.
Rebel back
if
at that.
If you're not speaking, let's mute.
Yeah. But, so because of that, I think I was sort of left to make my own decisions about religion and didn't have a lot of hangups about that. That gives me sort of the luxury of being a low voltage atheist, who doesn't really have a chip on his shoulder about it. So I think that's part of the context I try to keep in mind, though, is that, you know, there is such a thing as that, you know, there is still a vein in this country, outside of this country and other parts of the world, not in Europe, but in other places where religion is taken much more seriously still, and especially in other less modernized religions, there is a hard vein of religious obscurantism and intolerance, and where people are still threatened for not believing in a particular religious origin story or what have you. And so I sort of understand where some people are coming from in being more belligerent atheists, because, you know, they're reacting against what was thrown at them. But I try to be sort of a more help reason people through it. So my attitude is more summed up by, it's a legend, or I don't know if it really was ever actually happened, but this is the story that's told, is I think it was Laplace, one of the great French mathematicians and scientists, physicists who met Napoleon, and Napoleon, who fancied himself an intellectual, said, "Oh, I read your book on the solar system, and the one thing I noticed is that you made no mention of the divine creator." And Laplace is supposed to have said to him, "I have no need for that hypothesis." And that's sort of how I feel about my atheism, is that it's you know, all the questions that religion is, that a belief in God is supposed to answer for other people: the origin of the universe, the origin of man, the origin of humans, the nature of morality, all the things that they feel they need religion for. I think I've found perfectly reasonable secular explanations or answers for those questions, and so I have no need of the hypothesis of God. And that's sort of the way I try to sell people on, you know, here's why you shouldn't need it also. The other aspect of it too, by the way, is I'm one of the big influences on me, even before I discovered Ayn Rand, was Carl Sagan's series Cosmos, the famous television series he did. And he has his own goofy notions, but in rewatching it recently, because I wanted my kids to see it, one of the big things I noticed about Cosmos is one of the continuing themes of it, and it's something that came from Sagan's previous work, is the idea that science can also be a source of spiritual meaning. Yeah, you know, that the explanations the science gives of the universe, the explanations it gives of man, can also be fulfilling and deep and profound spiritual sources of spiritual meaning. And he actually wrote a book called The Varieties of Scientific Experience, which was supposed to be sort of an answer to, I think, William James wrote a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience. And so one of Sagan's books was The Variety of Scientific Experience, to show that this
is can be can that science and reason can provide their own sort of answers to the big spiritual questions.
Yeah, and Roger, to your point also about leadership, I think that is important. And our founder is David Kelly, and it's not necessarily that he takes a different view on, you know, the metaphysics or epistemology of objectivism being the natural world and reason over faith as our means of discovering it. But you know, his work on truth and toleration, his book on rugged individualism, it's this idea of benevolence as a self-interested value that if we have you know, nothing to fear, then, you know, we can learn from other people. And so I think it's more of that it's not a humility, that wouldn't be the right word to describe it, but a recognition that we have, you know, potentially a lot to learn. And we're certainly not going to convince anybody of our point of view if we just kind of lead with this idea that we have all the answers. And it's not a very appealing proposition.
Yeah, also, my outlook on it is in the context of today's culture wars. I like to say that my plan for the culture war is that culture wins. You know, the culture should win the culture war. And what I mean by that is that you should measure success in the culture wars not by what you destroy, not by how you can shut somebody down or shut somebody up. You should measure it by what you can create and by the answers that you can give and by how appealing and convincing you can make your own argument. So you should think of it in terms, not in terms of a negative of, oh, I have to destroy this other person and really come up with the perfect put down that will cause them to slink away in defeat. But in terms of how can I offer the best explanation and the best, most fulfilling and most convincing, most appealing vision for what my answer to the big questions is.
I love that. I love that. Thank you so much. I'm going to move myself back down. Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Anyone else have a question or a comment for Rob Trusinski? Thoughts on Christmas? Buyinza, you are a newcomer to Clubhouse. I see on your icon.
I'm a newcomer. I'd like just to thank you guys. I've been hearing your discussions, and that's really great. I'm new here. That's why I've been not understanding some of the things here.
Great. And, where are you from?
I'm from Uganda.
Terrific. Well, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to have you all, dear friends.
All right, Rob. So, what's next?
We have a new person here. It's great.
Yes,
we've talked about this with the Atlas Society before. That the sort of global reach of things of having. I know we have some people here who are involved in Sociedad Atlas, the Latin American version of it. I mean, it's one of the great advantages of the internet era. Is, you know, we can reach out to a lot of places that. Would have been hard to people would have been hard to reach, or places would have been hard to get the message to, in without the technology we have today. I really love the idea of expanding the scope of the people you can talk to.
Yeah, and I think that having an open and welcoming attitude towards people who are religious or Christian or what have you. And then also making room for, you know, even if you're an atheist, you can also enjoy being a part of a religious community. I, you know, sing in my temple's choir and frequently go to Chabad, and nobody bothers me about that.
Well, so there is a long tradition of the secular Jew. I mean, that's sort of like almost an American cliche, right? The guy who goes I went to college with a bunch of guys who basically were go off at temple all the time. And I said, you believe in the God? They'd say, oh, no. but, you know, I do the same thing that pre-pandemic, we were regulars in the South Plains Presbyterian Christmas caroling troupe. And it's because I wanted half my kids to have the experience of going around caroling. And my dad, so we go to my dad's church and we do that. So, like I said, it comes from being the low voltage atheist who doesn't have a chip on his shoulder. And, you know, I associate religion with my grandparents who were, you know, total salt of the earth people who I really loved and admired. So, I think, though, I recognize that there are people who had a less happy experience and that there are more fanatical and obscurantist and less pleasant versions of Christianity and of religion in general that people have to confront and deal with.
Alan is here.
Hey, Alan. Yes, I just saw your message. I just logged on. So I'm afraid I'm late to the conversation. I can only add, I guess I'm assuming you're going to end it too. I'll just add quickly that I think the best take when you're talking about Christmas as a religious holiday and capitalism is, if you've never seen it, the TV show South Park, their original pilot that they used to get the show, has Santa Claus and Jesus fighting in a death match over who's going to control Christmas. And in the end, the two of them make up and they say, and the moral is, well, the commercialization of Christmas helps keep the meaning of Christmas alive and vice versa. And that the holiday wouldn't exist without the religious, commercialization couldn't happen if there wasn't a real holiday behind it. So it's a really funny video. And
I think I see clips of that. I've never watched, never a great South Park watcher, but I've heard about that one.
Yeah, I'm not either, but I think I've seen a few things from it, but yeah, that's
in rejoinder to that, I could commercialize the heck out of Saturnalia. So, you know, I don't think we needed Jesus for that.
Yeah. But I'll just add that to the conversation and quit and leave it at that.
I had no idea, Alan, and that's a great find. I'll check it out. Lawrence, our editor, is here.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me.
Celebrating his holiday in Texas.
Yes, indeed. It's wonderful 60 degrees. What I was going to ask you, Robert, was, so today's the 21st, solstice day, shortest day of the year. Some people would say it's the death of the sun day, so to speak, among more pagan audiences. And the reason I bring that up is because I've been noticing an interesting discussion that's suddenly come up in recent days among your more Christian saying this is, you know, Christian holiday and all that stuff, and then pagan people, which I don't know how many of them there are, but they certainly seem vocal all of a sudden, and they're talking about their own ownership of this time of year and such, and there seems to be this, at least online, this scuffle between the two over these particular days. Interested to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, there is a weird sort of neo-pagan thing going on right now, but it's very, very small. I think there's some neo, like Odin worshippers in Scandinavia and things like that. Really what it, because the thing is that society can't go backwards intellectually. You can't go, having gone from paganism to Christianity, you can't just go back to paganism. You go on to secularism. And I think that's primarily what's happened there. I just saw a thing came out today. Somebody was touting it, that there's a new Pew survey that shows that for the first time, the number of atheists and the number of people who are atheists, agnostic, or describe themselves as having no particular religious belief, that group together outnumber the number of evangelical Christians in the country. And that's a new thing. It's like there's a larger group than it used to be just 5-10 years ago. And so I think what we are, we're grappling with the fact, and there's the whole context for this, and the war on Christmas, and that, you know, Fox News getting worked up about the war on Christmas every year, and people talking about commercialization, et cetera. What we're grappling with is that we are, in fact, becoming a more secular society, that religious belief, traditional Christian religious belief is fading, and atheism or like I said, nothing in particular is the largest group. People who have no particular religious belief, that group is rapidly growing. And so we're going to have to sort of grapple with, well, what is the meaning of a holiday like Christmas that had an original Christian meaning? And now, you know, now that we're all secular, what do we do with that? And how do we find a different meaning in it that isn't dependent on necessarily the Christian overlay that was put on it for the last 2,000 years?
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, I think I want to put in something here, because I think Jennifer's probably about to plug what I'm going to be doing next week. Now, next week for the Clubhouse, I'm going to be doing the top stories of the year. And the plug I want to put in here is I'm counting these down. This is something I do every year with my newsletter, the Trzezinski Letter. And you can go to trzezinskiletter.substack.com. Got to get the plug in. I have to turn my writer's card in if I don't plug my Substack newsletter. But I'm counting it down right now, in the middle of counting down, what were the top five stories of the last year that I've covered them and as I've observed them in my newsletter. And so next week I'm going to be talking about that, and sort of, you know, end of the year, looking at what were the five big things that happened in politics and in the culture over 2021.
Excellent. And then we also have our next Clubhouse is Thursday with our founder, David Kelly. He's going to be talking about objectivism and the arc of life, which is something he's been working on in his objectivist workshop. And we also have Professor Stephen Hicks's course on capitalism, session number 6 is coming up. That is tomorrow. So I want to encourage all of you to check out the Atlas Society website. Go to the events section. You'll see everything that we have coming up. And thanks, Rob. This was a great conversation.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
All right. I'll see you guys next time. Oh, and join me tomorrow on the Atlas Society Asks. I'm going to be doing a live webinar with Alex Kaczynski. He presided over the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for decades and has had some interesting experiences with objectivism, which we'll talk about. So see you then.